one thing I think, which is, there are divides in all cities. I should say that. There are divides in all our major cities. The divides do vary, but the slope of the divides is similar. And almost every city I've lived in, people have told me this is one of the most divided cities in Britain, and come up with some reason why it is one of the most divided cities in Britain, and it has its rich enclave and its poor areas and its areas in between. But the slopes are similar. If you go to a more equal country like France, the slopes tend to be less. If you go to a very equal country like Tokyo, people often don't know what you mean when you talk about slopes, because there are far fewer very rich areas and far fewer very poor areas. And if you ask to go to the very poorest part of the very poorest city in Japan, they say you can, and they show you how to get there. And then when you say, well, will you come with me, because I don't really want to go on my own, they say, no, you don't need that. You'll be perfectly safe. And that's the difference, I think, between areas. All these cities in Britain have these kind of inequalities. They're all very wide. But Oxford has this peculiar hierarchy of inequality between the top, most prestigious private schools, the middle-ranking private schools, the not-quite-so-good private schools, the top comprehensive, and people who would never send their children to a top comprehensive because they'd only go for the private, the second comprehensive, and people who would send their child to the top one but not the second because that is a fate worse than death. And then you go down one more level. It's better over here, at least, because Matthew Arnold at least covers the whole of this side of the city. You go down one more level and people desperately desire to be able to move house so they can get up into that school. Other people would kill not to let their children in. It may be that I grew up here that I feel this fairly strongly. And I'm a parent and I've had children living in other cities, so I know it happens everywhere, but I would challenge you to find anywhere where there were so many gradations of desire between schools and fear of this than a city that is supposedly famous for education. And it's a conundrum. It has to be worked out. And could it be that there are so many academics in this city who are so wrought up about wanting their children to kind of get the A's they got because they were geeks and strange, and academics don't realise that if they're lucky their children will be a bit more normal and will not behave in the same way that they have. I mean, could that be part of the reason? It may not just be that. I'll give you a couple of other examples of things which are different. I used to live in Sheffield, I used to live in Bristol. And the remarkable difference between Sheffield and Bristol is that Sheffield sends 1% more children to university than Bristol. Going to university is no longer an elitist thing, it's what half of all young women in Britain do. Sheffield, big poor northern city, sends 1% more children to university than Bristol, our richest large metropolitan area in the country. What can explain that? The best explanation I can come up with is that Sheffield has hardly any private education, so the top six or seven comprehensives do very, very well. They have the pushy parents, so there's almost nowhere else for the pushy parents to send their children. In Bristol, which has a very high private sector provision, rather like Oxford, the pushy parents will pay, corral themselves into this small set of schools, and children with parents with slightly less money are less likely to find themselves sitting next to the teacher's daughter or the doctor's son, where the expectation is you're going to go on to university. I don't know how to prove this because we don't have enough cases of cities to actually do this. And we have another further exception which is very different, which is London. Because if private provision was this bad in terms of what it does for the city, London should have terrible exam results because London has a very high rate of going to private schools. But London has incredibly good exam results for GCSEs. The children in the poorest tenth of areas in London get better exam results than children in the whole of Norwich, in the whole of Norfolk. Why is that? People talk about various schemes that have been done to do with teachers in London. I can't help thinking it has more to do with immigration to London. If you fill a city full of people turning up who've got real get up and go, even if they have to work delivering pizzas, they want their children to do slightly better than them. And that's a big difference between London and between Bristol. There are terrible examples of that difference. The worst I heard were parents from Afghanistan who beat their children if they didn't do their homework well enough because they had such a chance in London. But you can see how that would have an effect on producing better GCSE results in London. What should a city like Oxford do? How can a city like Oxford begin to sort itself out better? Just going back and remembering at the start or halfway through, I showed you that graph saying that education systems can make a difference even if your country is very unequal, or even if your country is quite equal, education systems can reduce mobility. I've often wondered whether Oxford is not small enough, that the six or seven major state schools of the city couldn't be treated more like one school, which would allow you to move resources between them, which would allow you to move teachers around them, so there was much less a stigma of going to one site of that one school. Call it Oxford High School, just to really confuse, because there are at least two called that already. What doesn't make that desirable? What doesn't make that kind of thing possible? Or would it not help at all, because people would still remember what the sites were? The last thing I'll leave you with about that is that I do think you can make a difference. If you go back long enough in Oxford, my mum first taught at what was Littlemore Grammar in this city, just as it stopped being a grammar school. Littlemore Grammar is on the site of that school, which is now amongst the 25 schools with the lowest exam results in the country. We celebrated an improvement in the exam results last summer, but the improvement doesn't look that great if you come back to the city from afar. Littlemore Grammar was a desired school, the school that people wanted to get to in the 1960s and 70s. There isn't necessarily a problem with the site or with the geography. I think you can look back and say you can do things. But if what you do is turn all your schools into academies, get them all to fight and compete with each other, all you're going to see is these divisions widening and widening between the schools, and the schools becoming more and more exam factories to try to keep their status up, to stop themselves going into special measures, having another set of governors imposed upon them, having another private sector firm take them over, having another academy sponsor, having to change their name again. That's my fear about where we're currently going, but I think it's possible to move away from that, and I think that the strongest force that could help us move away from that is the fact that amongst that top 10% of people in a city like Oxford, apart from the top 1%, the others are now beginning to suffer for the first time in decades, are going to find it harder and harder to pay school fees, and may begin to realise that their children are not going to benefit, even though they're amongst the top 10%, from living in a country that's organised in this way. Thank you very much.
Enough to be thinking about there, some really sort of shocking sort of insights into inequality as far as I'm concerned. Does anyone have any questions to start off?
Thanks for an excellent talk. I've got a million questions. I'm going to narrow it down. I'm very interested in this narrative because I'm kind of local and across the tracks and ended up working at what was Pierce School, so obviously followed after your mother. I'm now working at Oxford Brookes, not in the School of Education. And I'm a councillor at Rose Hill.
Yeah.
So it touches a lot of points. And what I'm very exercised about at the moment is the civic role of the university. That when I grew up in the council states of Oxfordshire, there was a sense of the Oxford Polytechnic being a point of access, the point at which higher education had a friendly face. I didn't actually go to Oxford Poly, but it was there, and there was a sense that it was ours in a way that the university wasn't. I'm not sure that Brookes operates in that same way. It's one of the things I'm exploring in my own work, and I'm wondering if you had any thoughts about the role of the university, because what we haven't mentioned is that we've got this massive education institution that could be doing more.
Yeah. And try and do some things, and I think they try and do the wrong thing. Oxford Brookes was the local university. Hefke did an analysis, I think, about 10 years ago to look at where there was another provision of universities. It resulted with Lincoln getting a university and so on. And it wasn't highlighted at the time, but they identified black holes. They called them areas of the country which were suffering from a lack of university provision. And they measured the lack of university provision by where were children very unlikely to go to university. And one of the places they found a lack of university provision was Oxford. And they should have highlighted it more. Oxford Brookes will tell you, or they told me, that they take 20% of their intake locally. What they mean by locally is Oxfordshire. they would not give me a figure for Oxford. And that's the big difference. And there's always been this massive antagonism between the county and the city. The county's always been conservative, the city's been Labour. This is a real issue of what you do. But the other real issue is, what is it that keeps parts of the city poor? And what keeps parts of the city poor is the fact that the university, and particularly the colleges, do not pay the living wage to their staff. The university has all kinds of initiatives of things it wants to do and sending people out to help and so on. But if you want children in the primary schools that are doing the worst to have books to read at home, you need to pay their parents enough money to buy the books. I don't think it's going to take more than, say, 10 years to get this over, because if you don't understand this, you're stupid. And the university doesn't want to look like it's stupid. It probably has to be done more subtly than I've just done it now. And you want to, I think you want to try to work out what is the best route whereby you can reduce the embarrassment of the fact that the universities, and particularly the university, is part of the reason and the problem why this pattern persists. The other, of course, big thing that's changed since I was in Oxford is there were two things in Oxford. They weren't the two universities. The two things that there were was there was a massive car factory which employed thousands and thousands of people and university. And when that was the case, you had higher incomes in the poorer areas. And the divisions were less, the income differences were less. And now the car factory employs far fewer people than essentially the universities have won. And given that's now happened, the need to look at the bottom wages, and the hospital as well, but they're not quite as bad, is fairly acute. I can't think of anything universities do. And it doesn't cost them that much. And what's really interesting, and you can tell I haven't been here long enough because I haven't learned not to say this, it is the richest colleges who are most resistant. And I'm embarrassed by this, because how on earth can I have been studying this since I was 18 and now in my 40s, and I still don't understand why people with the very most money are most reticent to give a little bit more to people with the least. And if somebody wants to quietly come up and tell me afterwards, there's a really obvious reason. But the fact that the colleges that have an embarrassment of riches, and in the last few years the college endowment funds have gone up dramatically along with the incomes of the 1%, I think they have a problem, or there is a difficulty, and it needs some help in working its way out. And the question is how best to do that, which is probably not as crass as I'm doing it now. But I don't believe it's impossible to do. And I do worry that all the various schemes and things that are said, and the university has targets set by government over what it's supposed to do in actions, will have very little effect compared to this tiny increase in wages, which would actually be cheaper than the cost of the various initiatives that are being tried. I'm not arguing for complete equality. If you ask me what I'm arguing for, I'd argue that we should be like the Netherlands, which is the most equal, sorry, the middle country of those countries, simply because we're at the bottom of the class at the moment. So the idea that you could take one of the most unequal countries in the rich world and make it, I mean, you're talking about complete equality. Even in Japan, there are huge differences. Cleaners only pay twice as much as a cleaner in Britain. That's £13 an hour. A doctor could be heading towards £100 an hour. That's in Japan. So you still have a big difference. I think it's realistic in Britain to try to aim to be like the Netherlands. They're not that different from us. They used to be a world power. It's just a very long time ago. But it's possible to do. Over medical school, though, There's been lots of initiatives about medical school intakes. I think it's well worth stepping back and saying, just what is a 17-year-old doing when they decide at that age that they want to spend the rest of their life dealing with ill people? Because it's actually quite a hard job emotionally. And I would alter medical school intake so that medics were... Well, I wrote a letter to the BMJ with some friends a few years ago to say this. If you sign up to medical school, you'll be obliged at the end of your training to spend 2 years in one of the worst countries in the world. And the reason I would do that is it would make you think a lot more before you signed up at 17 or 18 to do it. We get 10 really good AAA star applications for every medical place now. It would reduce the number of applicants for people to think about it more. But more importantly, and this is purely selfishly, if our medics did spend 2 years working in somewhere where they dealt with people dying on a regular basis who were quite young from infectious diseases, if or when we ever get the flu epidemic or anything really bad coming here, at least our medics would be able to deal with it. I think you need to worry about very privileged children deciding they want to do medicine and not quite realising what it is they've signed up to. And getting out of that at the age of 25 or 30 is very difficult. And we often don't look at it that way. We worry about the aspirations of the poor. What are they going to try and do? Can we try and get them into medical school or something else? We don't look at the number of people amongst the rich who make a mistake of their choice, partly because their choices are so constrained, because they're told you've got to go into a career which in a few years will earn you £50,000 or more, or a lawyer in London who can get £100,000 within 2 years. So the people who are least free to choose what job they do are actually the people who've gone to the most prestigious schools in this country and are being channeled into a very small number of occupations. Okay, about Singapore. Let's do about the education first, or the PISA results on the exam studies. These are interesting. If you look at them, I haven't got a graph, you'll be grateful to know. But in numeracy, we rank with USA right at the bottom, which kind of makes sense, because how can you fool the majority of people into letting the 1% get richer and richer? Well, you can if they're enumerate, and we are the most enumerate on PISA. But the countries that do highest, Korea and China and Japan, a lot of their teaching is teaching people just to get to the level of maths where they would score very high on PISA results, or get a GCSE A. I'll tell you, I can't help doing anecdote. My wife hates maths, she's no good at maths, and went to the kind of school where you were buying your results. And so she was taught maths, where she learnt by memory every single fraction and what it turned into as a decimal, so that she could answer the questions on the exam paper and get an A. She got an A at maths. She can't work out VAT. She's lovely, but she can't do this. But you can train people to pass at maths in that way. My maths teacher is sitting in the audience. You can train people to do maths in a different way, which means they can carry on and go and do more maths, more complicated maths, and then eventually when they get to 22, in my case, bang, they can't do it anymore. But that's, if you're looking at these countries that have done very well on these exam results, I wouldn't get too carried away by they've done this well, because the way in which they're teaching maths scores you highly at 15 or 16, but doesn't help you cope with rotating vectors and dealing with green spaces in your 20s in the maths degree. Singapore is an odd example. It partly has these kind of inequalities, or manages to keep them so high because of the way it controls the poorest people in Singapore. There's over 100,000 servants in Singapore, maids, mostly women. Those women are pregnancy tested now every 3 months. It used to be every 6 months. And if you're found to be pregnant, you're deported. And that means you can pay them very lowly because they don't have children, and you can bring in another set of poor people, and you can keep that gap that big. Now, we should know all about this, because this is upstairs, downstairs. This is the British country house, the most common occupation for your great-grandmothers, was to be a servant in a house. And the one thing the servants couldn't do is have children. So that's what I don't like about Singapore, is it's sustainable only if you have one group of the population who basically are not allowed to reproduce unless they go back to where they come from. And the point of raising it to do with Britain is that recently people have been suggesting guest worker schemes where we let people into the country but they have to leave if they have a child. And it's only Singapore that does this. And once you begin to do that, the next thing you do, you enter pregnancy testing every 3 months.
Thank you so much for that. The facts are, as ever, really fascinating, particularly about a city like Oxford. I'm really interested in the way in which we might be able to change the narrative a little bit, because I think that 30 years of everything being personal responsibility, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, get on with it, and pass as many exams as you can, which frankly is such a load of old rubbish when you start looking at the facts. Why do you think it's so difficult for a country like Britain to change that story and actually start to address what at the root seems, for me anyway, to be the kind of thing that lies beneath all of this, which is economic inequality, and that fundamentally we've put so much emphasis on education as the complete panacea for all ills, when actually there's something else that really needs to be addressed? So I don't know if you've got any reflections on that, because I'd be really interested to know them.
I think a lot of this is in hindsight. Looking back at it, as the economic gaps are widening, as the salaries are widening, you can see why education became seen as more important, because it's your route out, and hence why there wasn't opposition to examining children every year. So, I mean, for most of my teaching career, I've received these completely washed out 18, 19-year-olds who are utterly exhausted because they've been tested so much, done the hardest exam in their life, which is A-levels. Don't realise they're about to do the easiest exam in their life. It's very, very hard to fail at university. If you look at it, right? But have also had quite a lot of imagination kicked out of them and want to know about the exam. And then you have to look, the first two exams don't count for anything. You know, I mean, you can fail them and be asked to resit, but they don't go on any record. And they're still used to that. So I think it's the economic inequalities that have driven that. And then you get boys saying, we have to shake the cornflake packet and you need to get your children to be special little cornflakes that are going to somehow float. Well, I just think it's a brilliant analogy. Can you know about cornflakes? You know, they're all very similar to each other. Do you think there are any special cornflakes that float to the top of a cornflake packet? That's why. Why can't we talk about economic inequality instead? One thing that makes Britain different from other countries is that we have been slowly sliding down in terms of our economic power, our military power, our place in the world, since we owned half the world only 100 years ago. So if you're asking people in Britain to become more equal, you're asking those at the top to take a really big hit. And those at the top have been used to being at the very top of the world. And that is quite a big ask, or a bigger ask. The time, if you want to look back at it when we asked it, was in the elections in 1974. There were two elections in 1974. And in the second election in 1974, in October, the southeast of the country just swung to the Conservatives. They didn't swing enough for the Conservatives to win, but the voters went that way. And what I find interesting is they did that before Margaret Thatcher was elected leader in 75, and they did it before the winter of discontent. And in effect, the southeast and a large number of people said they didn't want to give up any more as they were becoming relatively poorer. They wanted to jettison the north, jettison the poor, and I'll be okay, Jack. And then increasing numbers voted through the 80s to allow that to happen until we eventually saw what we got. But my answer to why we find it so hard is that if within just a few generations you have been the most powerful country in the world and you're heading slowly, desperately towards becoming a more normal European country, this is not easy to do. And it's very hard for your ruling elite to understand. No. When Grandad used to control the whole of Kenya, how come you can't get a job doing this? And if you sort of see it that way, I think it's easy to understand why we've got a problem. And easy to understand why the US has a massive psychological problem. Because how does the US cope? a country which saw such massive increases in living standards, where people got to a position in the 1950s and 60s where it really was a kind of utopia for the average person. How do they cope with what's happened since? And that's harder than a normal country, a normal psyche. And the other thing you get in a normal country is a much higher degree of solidarity, because you've had less of these divisions in the past, because you've dealt with a trauma which everybody had to deal with. And often, although people criticise this explanation, when you look at some of those countries like Japan or Finland or Norway, I think it does kind of help if you all speak the same language and nobody else much speaks your language. It's harder not to see other people as human if they're very like you, because you've got that in common. Whereas the English, we've become very good at not seeing other people as like us, partly because you have to think that way to actually run an empire. You couldn't be a nice liberal softy and take over the world. But we still have in us the idea of not necessarily seeing other people like us, and so other people's children deserving the same kind of things as our children.
Questions?
You're on the hour. You got one last one?
I had a question, if I may, about this first question that you have up there. Would that be your solution to the sort of to the current geography of comprehensive education? Would that be the solution to the kind of, you know, the distinctions that we get in comprehensive schools now?
I call them high schools. I think the biggest mistake with comprehensives was not, you know, Beverly Hill High is a comprehensive. So I think the name was wrong. It's just for a city the size of Oxford and smaller ones where you've got two schools or three schools. Almost always these two schools or three schools end up having this difference between them. And I think when you are that small, up to the size of Oxford, I can't believe it's impossible. And we've got these massive management teams in schools. When I was at my school, it really was only the head and somebody else, yeah? And it still worked. Yeah. Now there are the massive management teams. It must be capable for these large management teams of schools to run five sites rather than one. But you have to be sensitive. In London, not doing this works. In London, what works is having this enormous choice, so children can choose where they want to go and fit in. And that does seem to help kids in London, because they do seem to do well. In Bristol, you have a different problem. In Sheffield, okay, we had our secondaries tended to be okay, although big differences. But our primaries, we couldn't get primary heads at all. You advertised and you couldn't get people to apply to be primary heads. So it's very different in different parts of the country. I think you need different solutions. The very last thing I'll say before letting you go is if you sort of think it all changes, one really instructive thing is to look at an old map of a town and to draw around where its schools are, its school playing fields. And you'll find that although everything else changes, it's almost always the same buildings and the same places that this has taken place in, that we built. So the change has actually not been about building new sites or moving entirely. We've done many very different education systems, but we tend to have done it on the same physical sites, such that the college I'm now at is apparently originally where the very forefront of the school I went to was based at in the middle of Oxford. It had done education for hundreds of years. It's how we do it that changes, and that's much easier than building a whole new set of places. Thank you very much for all your attention.